You're listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on WRIR's weekly audio news digest, the man, the myth, the legend, Virginia State folklorist John Lohman talks about the Virginia Folklife Apprenticeship Program and preserving Virginia's important oral traditions and histories. Also, it's time to preserve your own oral traditions and histories. Open Source RVA, in collaboration with the Virginia Center for Latin American Arts, announces its participation in Vox RVA, an audio archive of Richmond's diverse communities and where they came from, as told by you. Vox RVA kicks off, assuming this rain ever lets up, tonight, First Friday. But here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Brittany Tracy, and here's the news. Richmond Outreach Center founder Geronimo Aguilar's offer to resign his senior pastor post at the Southside Megachurch was approved by the Rock's Board of Directors on Wednesday. Aguilar was scheduled to appear yesterday in Texas, facing 7 felony charges alleging sexual improprieties with 2 minor girls in 1996. Fort Worth arrest warrants in the case became public last week and include details about the circumstances of the interaction. Meanwhile, 3 more Rock pastors also have resigned, including Jason Helmlinger, a former Henrico police officer who was charged with threatening a disaffected parishioner. Meanwhile, the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests is criticizing the Rock's leadership for proclaiming Aguilar's innocence. SNAP has asked the Rock leadership to retract their declaration. The Rock long has led various community outreach programs, including the Violence Free Zone School Program, funded through the Richmond Police Foundation. An Open Source RVA Freedom of Information Act request reveals the extent of the Rock's past support by Governor Bob McDonnell. While McDonnell was the state's attorney general, he partnered with Aguilar. Since 2004, the AG's office has allocated $21,000 to the Rock for their community service projects, including youth mentoring. AG's office spokesman Brian J. Gottstein said that, quote, Geronimo Aguilar, like everyone else in the programs they sponsor, went through the required background checks. Don Blake, president of the Virginia Christian Alliance, spoke with Richmond Public Media, criticizing the Rock's response, and said, quote, the ministry needs to be continued, but not under the current leadership. He calls for dissolving the current board of directors so that the Rock might reestablish credibility as a community. In the meantime, Blake says Rock members should visit their local churches. Hey you, put down that McBurger. According to the Virginia Beach-based People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Richmond is the 10th most vegan-friendly city in the country. What's got us so veggie-rific in PETA's estimation? We host festivals celebrating what the release called compassionate culture, and we're home to many vegan-friendly restaurants, bakeries, bars, and businesses. Looking the other way on this week's Bacon Festival in Chaco, Mayor Jones acknowledged the honor and credited the city's various meat-free restaurants and food carts like 821 Cafe, Rooster Cart, Phoenix Garden, Harrison Street Cafe, Ipanema, and the bakery RVA Vegan. Mayor Jones takes some credit as well, having launched the Healthy Richmond campaign in 2011. This year's Richmond Vegetarian Festival takes place next Saturday, June 15th, from noon to 6 p.m. at Bryan Park. Do you have a doctorate in school administration? Your superintendent licensure? 5 or more years of experience in the field? Can you stand, sit, and walk? Lift up to 10 pounds? Time to dust off your resume and apply to become Richmond Public Schools Interim Superintendent. Apply online by visiting www.topschooljobs.com.
In Richmond, it's always been about who your people are, who your daddy was, where you come from.
It's a good question, and we want to hear your family story. Teaming with the Center for Latin American Art, or VACLA, Open Source RVA kicks off Vox RVA, a radio series about your kin, starring you, talking about your diverse roots and who your daddy was, where you came from.
And we want to hear from you. So join us each and every first Friday, as well as at dates and locations to be announced on the Vox RVA Facebook page and at rvaopensource.com. Check the website and keep it tuned to future Open Source RVA broadcasts to hear these oral histories.
Vox RVA. Each of us has a unique story to tell, and together we tell the story of Richmond.
Don't it seem so far away? We're traveling light today. In the eye of the storm.
Oh, get on board.
Get aboard, little children.
Get aboard.
Get aboard, little children.
Get on board.
Get aboard, little children.
I know
there's room for many more.
No harm to get on board.
Get aboard, little children.
Get aboard.
Get aboard.
When he became the state folklorist of Virginia more than a decade ago, John Lohman made it a priority to start an apprenticeship program that would pair disappearing Virginia master craftsmen, musicians, and folk artists with younger practitioners. That apprenticeship program itself became a tradition last year, marking a decade as an ongoing and inspiring success story. That's a whole lot of knowledge transference. Looking back, the list of cultural specialties that this program has preserved is staggering in its scope, encompassing everything from West African and Chickahominy Indian traditions to decoy carving, boat building, canning, basket making, and automobile pinstriping, even Brunswick stew cooking and oyster shucking. Lohman casts a wide eye, and Virginians should be thankful for his ears, too. For the past several years, he's been the curator and ringleader of the Virginia stage at the annual Richmond Folk Festival. Lohman, working with his employer, the nonprofit Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, even started a record label designed to spotlight folk and bluegrass musicians along the Crooked Road music trail. He's also helped to guide such indigenous artists as the gospel a cappella group The Paschal Brothers and the old regular Baptist singer Reverend Frank Newsom to National Heritage Awards. Lohman's new recording of Richmond's own Maggie Ingram and the Ingramettes has been nominated for an Independent Music Award. And John's latest project, he's a busy, busy man, is a documentary on the life and career of Hampton Roads soul man turned preacher Charlie McClendon. John, thanks for coming. It's a real treat to have you here on Open Source RVA.
Oh, thanks, Don. It's great to be here. Appreciate it.
Hey, let's get the preliminaries out of the way. What is a state folklorist and why do we need him?
Well, I will say that most of the states in the country, not all of them, have what they call a state folklorist. And the idea is to kind of, I guess, divide and conquer a little bit around the country. And the idea is that, you know, we are, and as state folklorist, I direct the Virginia Folklife Program. And we are the state center for documenting and presenting, supporting, as you just said, as well as celebrating Virginia's rich folk life. And we define folk life as those various ways in which, over the course of daily life, that folks kind of express, often through aesthetic means, sort of who we are, you know, a connection to a particular community.
Right.
And that can be regional, it can be ethnic, it could be occupational. And so it encompasses music, as you said, all types of crafts, oral traditions, as well as occupational traditions, all kinds of things. It's just kind of the way in which we communicate, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. Hey, this is who we are, and it's Virginia's a great place to do it. It's a huge state.
Yeah, you're really talking about several different states within one state in many ways.
You really are. There's so many distinct regions to it, you know, when you're talking about the Piedmont, South Side. Of course, Southwest Virginia encompasses a part of that incredible region.
The ethnic traditions in Northern Virginia.
Oh, all over. You know, Hampton Roads, as you were just discussing. And so it's an incredibly diverse state. It has some of our oldest traditions. You know, mm-hmm. our Virginia Indians were the first ones really to encounter the West, you know, or rather Europe, as well as you said, a constant influx of vibrant communities from all over the world,
right?
And everything in between. So it's a great place to do this work, and I just feel blessed to be able to do it.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. You know, I should add a disclaimer here. I've not only worked on projects funded by the foundation, I have written about John and the Folklife Program before, most recently in Virginia Living. I've also worked with John before on projects. So you like family, John, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Thank you, Dan. And we appreciate your work.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Talk about the Virginia Foundation, what it does, and then talk about how the Folklife Program fits into that.
Okay, well, the foundation has been in existence now almost 40 years, coming on our 40th anniversary. It is it's an interesting organization because it's a hybrid of a number of things. It's essentially the State Humanities Council. It's also part of University of Virginia as kind of a research center. We're housed at the University of Virginia.
And how long has there been a state folklorist position?
It's coming on its 25th year.
Okay.
And I had one predecessor, Gary Barrow, who started the program, did some fantastic work. He left the program kind of in the late 90s, and there was a brief hiatus, and then they brought myself in there. You know, the foundation is essentially about the public, bringing the humanities out of sort of the halls of the academe to the general public.
Right.
And to have a reach that is statewide. It started predominantly with a grant program, and we still have that grant program. We fund, we give out usually about 20 to 30 grants a year to all sorts of cultural organizations across the state, libraries, museums, historical societies, cultural centers, theaters, you name it. And that has expanded over the years. We produce two radio programs. One's called With Good Reason. Folks in here in Richmond probably hear
great
that.
Show.
As well as a new show called Backstory, which is actually features Ed Ayers, president here at University of Richmond.
He's
one of the historians in that, one of the history guys, they call him.
The history guys.
But we've had programs focusing on African-American history and culture, and we still have that program. Virginia Indian Heritage Program started recently. We have a fellowship program. Scholars come in from all over the country for residencies. It's a very broad, large Virginia Festival of the Book, which is one of the largest book festivals in the East Coast. We have every spring. So it's really grown. And originally, Chuck Perdue, who is a fine folklorist, housed at the University of Virginia, he and his wife Nan did tremendous work on Shenandoah Park, folks who were oral histories of folks who were displaced when that park was created. He did great work. He was the one who really is responsible for bringing John Jackson to everyone's attention.
Right. He's the one who discovered him in the back of that gas station.
That's right.
Yeah.
As he said it, he said, you know, I didn't discover John because John was never lost. You know, I love that. But they were, you know, they've been, you know, Chuck passed away just several years ago. But Chuck and Nan approached Rob Vaughn, the president of VFH, about 25 years ago, and said, hey, Virginia is one of the states that currently does not have a state folklife program. And would you like to take it on? And they got funding initially through National Endowment for the Arts to start the position. And VFH, fortunately, saw the value in it and kept it on. I mean, you asked how it fits in with the rest of the foundation. I think one thing that I think has been a wonderful result of the program is we reach audiences and we reach people that often are typically not involved in humanities programming. There's kind of a general demographic, you could say, that typically come to the humanities programs.
Right.
We reach folks that, you know, never really, you know, I think most humanities councils don't really get to. And it fits really soundly in our mission. I should say, too, an interesting thing is in most state folklife programs are housed in arts councils.
Yeah.
There's a historical reason for that in terms of how they were originally formed.
Right.
Bess Lomax Hawes, Alan Lomax's sister, was sort of responsible for that initially. But in Virginia, my program is the only one housed in a humanities council.
I was going to say, that seems unusual.
Yeah, it is, and I think it's the perfect place for it. And when I get together with folklorists around the country at some of these gatherings that we have, conferences, I just, you know, I just thank my lucky star.
You don't have some of the political or logistical problems that they have.
Yeah, I mean, for one thing, we're not a direct state agency. But but beyond that, I think with folk life, you know, it's not just about the object itself. It's not just about the text or the story or the song. It's about the all that, how it operates within the culture, you know, the cultural context, the history. That's so much of what this is about. And I think in arts councils, the folk arts or traditional arts often become, if I could say it, sort of the stepchild there. You know, they're viewed as secondary to, you know, the fine arts.
The classical music.
Yes, yes.
The ballet, the
exactly.
Opera, yeah.
And you know, a basket or whatever is sort of viewed as a craft. And so there's such a focus on the object itself. And it's difficult for them to do the kind of work that we get to do, to do the field work we get to do, spend time in communities and really build these relationships, which is really the main part of my job, I'd say.
Talk about how the apprenticeship program works. You wrote the first grant for it in 2001?
That would have been the year I was hired. I was hired in 2001. I came in August, the end of August, about a week before 9/11, actually, is when I came on. And the deadline at the NEA was October the 1st for a grant. I'd never written a grant before. And, you know, I had there were models of this in other states, but also just when I hit the ground running, even really before I was officially hired, just driving all over the place and trying to – I'm not from Virginia originally and just talking to tradition bearers of all types. And that was a theme I kept hearing was, you know, we're kind of concerned – that this is going to get lost.
Yeah, this is disappearing.
This is disappearing. Young folks are, you know. And so it became really apparent that that was something that needed to happen. So that, you know, we fortunately got that grant in the following year. And that's where you mentioned the Paschal brothers and folks like Flory Jagoda, this incredible Sephardic ballad singer.
Beautiful.
I mean, that first class of apprenticeships, we had Audrey Hash Ham, who was Albert Hash's daughter, Albert Hash being the instrument maker down in Southwest Virginia that taught Wayne Henderson and other folks how to make instruments. It was a phenomenal group of folks. And, you know, each time it's a wonderful way, too, to really get to know these folks. We always go and spend time with them during their apprenticeship, and it opens up whole worlds. So it's really been a staple program for us since the beginning. And you know, it's in its 10th year. We usually try not to repeat traditions. Occasionally we do. But for the most part, and I should say, you know, it's not just traditions that are quote-unquote dying out. It's often, say, for example, we'll have a young bluegrass fiddler who wants to study with Buddy Pendleton, you know, who played with Bill Monroe and had a particular style. So it's also many of these traditions are doing quite well, but there's nothing that compares to getting to spend time
firsthand
with a master,
you
know. And so that's so it's really it meets a lot of purposes, as well as we have an event every year in Charlottesville. This year it is September the 15th. I encourage
this
your
is
listeners.
Your, this
yeah,
is
this
your
is
folk
our
festival.
Showcase, which is at our place over there.
It's near the Boar's Head, right
next to the Boar's Head Inn on Ivy Road. Where this year it's going to be September the 15th. It's a free festival. We feed you.
Oh, it's great.
We feed you great, you know.
You had some Brunswick Stew guys out
there.
Yes, we do every year. One time I was out there. It was awesome.
Every year we have them, and we're and fantastic music. All the participants in the program. So it becomes a way to really honor these people as masters, as well as a lot of times just even turn people on to this stuff even exists. You know, so.
Well, what I love about the program is just how wide-ranging it is. Can you talk a little bit about the criteria you use when you determine, hey, this should be preserved?
That's a good question. It's funny. You could get 100 folklorists in a room, and I think you'd have maybe 100 different opinions on that.
That sounds like a joke.
We know, yeah, right. We know folks who have, I think, a different conception of, you know, what is traditional and what is not.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of tradition, what we're trying to say.
I'd say that many of these traditions are deeply rooted in many generations, although some are quite new. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a good question. I mean, I think it's just, I think that in this world we're in now where everything is becoming so digital, everything's becoming so franchised, you know, the idea of local culture is mm-hmm. Something that, you can go into any town in America and eat the same chicken sandwich and walk into the same CVS and know what aisle to go to. And, mm-hmm. that things that really embody become a heart of a place or of a community of mm-hmm. To us are the kinds of things that we look for.
Right.
It's hard to kind of give a general criteria. It seems like, this work is very personal. It's kind of,
well, has there ever been anything that you've wanted to preserve and say someone at the foundation says, oh, come on, automobile pinstriping,
That was one.
Oyster shucking.
That was one. I have to say that, I have to give props here to Rob Vaughn, who's been the president of the foundation since its beginning. Mm. He started it.
Wow.
One time he was the lone employee of it, who, what I really love about Rob is he really just kind of, he trusts his staff, and he really handed me the keys to the, mm-hmm. to it, and he sort of said, "Well, hey, you're the folklorist. You have a degree in this stuff,
Yeah.
You tell me." But he did that first year when we had hot rod cars. That very first year,
mm-hmm.
which was somebody I met through Roddy Moore down at
the Blue Ridge Institute at Ferrum, yeah,
who's been an incredible resource over the years for us. Mm-hmm. Him and Vaughn Webb down there. He pulled me aside and he said, hot rod cars, I mean, that's not really folk life,
Mm-hmm.
And it opened up a great conversation, I was sort of like, well, why do you say that,
It's a community tradition after all.
Sure. And I said, so why do you say that? And he's like, well, it's not really old, which opened up this whole conversation about that. But I said, it's at least as old as bluegrass music is.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And then he was sort of like, well, it's... I think the idea that it was like metal, and involved like machines mm-hmm. and stuff, mm-hmm. this notion that folk life is has to be made of...
It's in the dirt with sticks.
Yeah, it has to be cloth and mm-hmm. textiles. And so it was really a great conversation. And in the end of the day, I get to make that call, which is, not everybody gets to make that call.
Well, we're glad you do. You've had the late Mike Seeger in the program.
Yes, we did. We had the late Mike Seeger in the program. We had the late John Cephas in the program.
Yeah.
The late Spencer Moore in the program. I mean, we've had some amazing people over the years who have passed
Wayne
on.
Henderson this past year.
Wayne Henderson, who,
teaching
God
his
bless,
daughter.
Is alive and kicking.
Yeah.
So we've, and having Mike in the program was an incredible thing because, so much, that's the thing about apprenticeship, I think. It's not just like, and his was officially in old-time banjo.
Right.
Taught a guy named Seth Swingle, who's a very accomplished musician now. Mike, they're having these get-togethers in Mike's house with his archive, and it really became as much about his work with, Doc Boggs and all these mm-hmm. other folks and about the whole notion of what it means to be a documentarian and a folklorist. And so Mike was an amazing person.
Yeah, he was a folklorist in his own right.
Oh, one of the best. He was one of these people that really was able to merge the two
mm-hmm.
to be both a folklorist and a historian and documentarian, and became an unbelievable musician
mm-hmm.
in his own right. Very serious guy.
Right.
He had a juxtaposition, kind of dichotomy of, on the one hand, he was very serious, came across sometime as a little prickly to people,
mm-hmm.
But also just one of the sweetest guys with great sense of humor.
Didn't suffer fools gladly, if I remember.
No, he didn't. Although he's full, he suffered me. That's a good way to put it. He, it's funny in contrast to his brother Pete,
mm-hmm.
I know they had a bit of a strained relationship. You know, Mike was the purist about this stuff.
Right.
He was kind of a hardcore about tradition, whereas Pete, I think, took a lot of liberties with it.
Mm-hmm.
All in a, I think,
didn't
a
mind
wonderful
appearing
way.
On the Smothers Brothers show.
I love both of them. I mean, I grew up in the Hudson River Valley, and Pete Seeger had a huge influence on my life. I mean, the Clearwater Festival that he started was my first experience with festivals, and you know what I ended up getting into.
Talk a little bit about how the apprenticeship program's going to go from here. You celebrated 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Any changes? Any deviations from what we've seen so far?
I wondered, you know, are you going to run out of things? Are you going to run out of people? Are you going to run out of traditions? And you just don't, you know, they just keep coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we already have some exciting possibilities, you know, even little simple things like beekeeper, you know, for example.
Right.
We were just talking about the gentlemen who work in carnivals.
Carnival barkers?
As well as folks who, you know, work this old carousel, handmade carousel, you know. I mean,
perfect example. You had a tobacco auctioneer was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And now in another state, under another program, that might not be considered.
Well, that's where I think also the humanities versus the arts as a home for this comes into play. I mean, you'd make a very difficult case that tobacco auctioneering is an art form, although it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible verbal art.
I know. Those guys are incredible.
But a lot of arts councils, that's a really tough sell.
Right. Because why preserve this? The art is dead. The reason why this was happening is over. Why preserve it?
Which, by the way, is what that particular master, Bob Cage, said to me. You know, he was one of the guys who was real resistant about an apprenticeship. He said, you know, why? I mean, this is done.
Yeah.
You know, why save this? And I had to kind of make the case to him that this is, if you've ever heard this, done. I mean, it's like a Gregorian chant. I mean,
yeah,
it's totally
like rapping.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And very few people could do it. And what he could do, too, besides doing it himself, was he could imitate. He remembered all the different guys. Most of them had passed on.
Uh-huh.
He said, this is how this guy did it.
Yeah.
And he would mimic it
like
to perfection.
So he was able to give you a glimpse of what others
exactly.
did. Yeah.
Exactly.
You're the tireless programmer behind the Virginia stage at the Richmond Folk Festival. And this past year was just about untoppable as far as I was concerned. You had all of Virginia's musical National Heritage Award winners represented in some way. Talk about what it takes to pull that off every year, programming that stage, but particularly this past year.
Well, gosh, I mean, one thing about it, you know, I think most of your listeners hopefully go to that festival. It's an incredible festival. You know, the Virginia Folklife area is the one part of the festival that is, first of all, focused on Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rest of the festival has artists from all over the country, all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Very diverse, whereas we really try to feature Virginia, and we work on a theme, which is not. I mean, I think if there was an overall theme for the festival, to me, it has something to do with pluralism and diversity. You know, you sit there at a stage and you hear a Chinese mouth harp followed by mariachi followed by go-go.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
whereas what we try to do is work with a particular theme, although it becomes extremely diverse too. So working on a theme, and we've had everything from, we did one called New Neighbors, which looked at all immigrant arts. We've done work traditions. We've done regional things. We've done stuff that often sometimes it gets pretty challenging because we also have a crafts element to it. So that's a challenge. I mean, it involves, I think, a certain kind of research that maybe the rest of the festival doesn't as much. You know, the rest of the festival, many of these musicians are professional touring musicians.
Yeah.
We work with a lot of folks who are amazing, but they are not professional touring musicians.
Right. They don't have an agent.
No.
You have to
no.
deal with them directly.
Exactly. Which has its own challenges and its own benefits. You know, I personally much prefer it than dealing with management and booking agents. But it involves then you're on the cell phone trying to steer Reverend Frank Newsom down the Powhite Parkway. You know, it's
the little logistical thing.
It's a whole different ballgame. But it's so rewarding when you know, these folks really, unlike, you know, maybe some of the stars, you know, these folks just to, you know, the festival treats the artists so well, you know, and just to be able to be in the hotel and get this kind of, you know, they just love it. So, but it takes a lot of work. I mean, we're deep into it now.
Yeah. How long does it take you generally every year to put that program together for the folk festival?
You know, we usually spend, I'd say a good 6 months working on it. And we have other things going on too. Our schedule in the summer just takes off.
Let's go. I'm ready for this church now. All right. I hope y'all gonna let me sing. It's a wild river.
Broadcast of WRIR is made possible in part by Rostov's Coffee and Tea, 1618 West Main Street, now featuring home delivery everywhere in the city. Details on the web at rostovs.com. And WRIR is sponsored by Secco Wine Bar, open every day from noon to midnight. Secco offers artisanal wines by the glass, craft beers, and house-made snacks, sandwiches, and small plates. 2933 West Carey Street at the corner of North Shepherd in Careytown.
Yeah, I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, because you're also doing other festivals.
Yeah, we're doing one this weekend. You know, we had the Barrier Islands Festival out in the Eastern Shore of Virginia.
Right.
I was just down in Galax doing something called Houston Fest, which is a festival in honor of a young banjo player who was killed tragically a number of years ago, but it's an incredible festival in his honor.
And when you say you do the festival, are you bringing artists there, or are you, how's it work?
It depends, you know. With the Barrier Islands Center one coming up, they entrusted me with essentially booking it, or at least letting them know who they should book.
Yeah.
And then as well as I'm going to MC it and curate some workshops. So, you know, it ranges. Some we just are sort of more, consultant role, and others we're soup to nuts. You know, we do Floyd Fest. We've been doing that for 8 years, a stage there called The Porch, which is we bring in traditional artists there. We handle all that. I do these workshops with a lot of the headline artists, deeply into that. Richmond, we're like, you know, everything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we work with Venture Richmond, who a wonderful partner, and National Council of Traditional Arts. So we're sort of a three-legged stool there. But we do that area pretty much from soup to nuts. And it's about, I'd say it's about 6 months. I mean, you know, we did a thing a couple years ago on contest traditions in Virginia.
Yeah.
And had real contests. That idea came to me when I was driving home from Richmond after the year before. Sometimes they just come. Some years are harder. We're sort of debating between.
Well, you know,
I'm
going to ask
right
you about
now.
Oyster shucking, because has become a very important part of the Virginia folklife stage.
Yeah.
This past one was out of hand.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, oyster shucking, and how you've integrated that into.
Well, you know, it's funny. Oyster shucking, the Chesapeake Bay used to be the main oyster producer, one of the top ones in the world, you know. It really took a dive for a while due to pollution and other factors, and it's really made a nice resurgence. But oyster shucking was a very important line of work, particularly for African-Americans and in the Northern Neck, Eastern Shore, right, around the whole Tidewater area.
And they would have work songs even.
Yeah, exactly. And at some point, it became a competitive sport, in part because they get paid by the quantity that they shuck.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a job where the faster you work, the more money you make. So,
right, and you're not just opening them. You're presenting them as well. I mean, it really is an art to it.
Oh, yeah. So it became a competitive sport on its own. And so we feature that. And we happen to have in Virginia a woman who is an international champion, a woman competing against the men, which is...
she's sort of the Muhammad Ali of oyster shucking.
She is. She's cocky. Her name is Deborah Pratt from a little place called Jamaica, Virginia, mm-hmm. and the Northern Neck. And her sister,
Her sister is also good.
She actually, her sister taught her how to shuck an oyster,
mm-hmm.
her older sister, Clementine. Mm-hmm. And the two of them kind of alternate winning state championships. They have the state championships in Urbana every year,
mm-hmm.
which basically they own that title. And then the nationals are in St. Mary's, Maryland.
Oh.
So it's on the Eastern Shore of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
So they own this. So to have these women here, and they are just such wonderful. I mean, they're just, you've seen them on stage.
Absolutely.
They're something else. What's fun about those too is you know, we have a half hour slot for that on the stage, and it's about a 3 minute contest.
Yeah.
So we have to
build
it up.
You work it.
So it's become quite the pageant.
In fact, did you or did you not make the champion a belt
past
year made out of oyster shells?
Made of oyster shells and Mardi Gras beads and hot glue gun and all that kind of stuff. We had the belt and the robe and the she came out to the Rocky theme, I think. And we make a big pageant. There's a wonderful video of this that we put up on our YouTube channel, if I could plug that.
Absolutely.
On YouTube, Virginia Folklife has a YouTube channel. And we've been working to put a lot more stuff on that now. We're digitizing all our collections and producing some wonderful stuff. VA Folklife. You can find it.
Yeah, people check that out.
So
and some other great stuff up there,
too. Yeah, so we have a number of things from Richmond. We have Maggie Ingram's performance.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Oyster Shucking Contest. We have some of Jesse McReynolds backstage. And we got a lot more to put up. So that's a good thing for folks to check out and subscribe to.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy. So you can get notices when we put something new up. And you should check that out. It's really something else.
Well, you've done a fair amount of work in Richmond since you've been state folklorist. I recall you did some research early on the career of Mr. Wiggles.
Yeah, Mr. Wiggles, who I know you're familiar with.
Yes.
Trying to
get him up here, actually.
Well, you know, another thing about folklife, you know, we talked about this before, that, you know, that's another whole thing.
I'm heading on this? This would be an area, soul music, that maybe some folklife programs would think, oh, that's commercial music. That's not really applicable to what we're doing.
And, of course, so when you interview these guys, and that's another thing we're going to have up on our site. We've been doing a lot of interviewing with a gentleman named Charlie McClendon, as you mentioned. And,
right.
And we've talked to Mr. Wiggles. It is a community-based. I mean, you know, this was so localized, this music. And it is an expression of an aesthetic, expression of a community. So I'd say on the scale, on the continuum of folklorists out there, I am very much on the, I guess I'm pretty loose. You know, I don't feel like my job is to be, you know, the folk police and say what's real and what's not real. To me,
I've met some officers from that force.
Oh, yes, there's some Gestapos in this state. you know, to me, hey, what do you mean it's not real? Here it is.
Yeah.
You know, I came from a different kind of training, I guess. I was more academically trained. I trained with a guy named Roger Abrams when I got my degree, who's just wild. You know, and to both of us, that stuff, that weird stuff on the margins is what is exciting to us. You know, so I guess I'm more open that way. I'm just kind of a playful with that, trickster with that. So I like to push the envelope. And so to me, and it's just, you know, another beautiful thing about my work, I'm very lucky, is that I get to also just follow things that I really dig, you know, and that's something that I just really love.
Well, you've done a lot of work with gospel artists, in particular this new live recording from Maggie Ingram and the Ingramettes.
Yes.
Talk about that project. She is so great.
She's incredible.
And has been for so many years.
50 years in Richmond.
Yeah.
A little over 50 years now. And, you know, we just... She's just somebody who is incredible. We're so lucky she's still with us. Mm-hmm. She, her family over the years has been, you know, the Ingramettes.
She's had a family band.
She's had a family band, and there's still members of her family in the group now. Her daughter, Almeda. Ingram Miller is really kind of the leader of the group, maybe.
Yeah, and has really grown into her own as a vocalist, I think.
Oh, my God. Yeah, powerful. And, you know, they're every Sunday they're in Petersburg, you know, in a prison down there with their ministry. But just incredible artists. And, you know, actually Maggie, I think, has had better studio recordings than a lot of them.
Absolutely. In fact, some of them, I think, are essential, really. Yeah, the Richmond Flood is exactly. apocalyptic almost.
But, you know, I've always been turned on by gospel music. And, you know, sometimes you'll see a group either at a church or at a festival and you're just like ecstatic and they have CDs and you get the CD and you bring it home and it's just, ugh, it's such a bummer.
Yeah.
Because they get in the studio and there's all these toys in there. And it to me, what so much about gospel is the spirit of it and the energy of it. And often that just gets lost in the studio. And you get these albums that are just completely, just feel like processed.
Just product.
Yeah, yeah. And so I, you know, with Maggie, I just really wanted to, I felt like she really deserved and needed, and we all needed, a really solid recording of her and to do it live.
Yeah.
And we didn't advertise it. It wasn't something like a festival stage, although she's awesome on a festival stage. We wanted it for, you know, they invited their, you know, Almeda's a reverend, and as is evangelist Maggie Ingram. So we had their congregations come, and we did
it. And Cheryl's a reverend, too, isn't she?
Yeah, yeah, and she's unbelievable, Cheryl Beaver. So they, we did it at Fifth Baptist Church here in town one evening, and it was phenomenal.
Right.
And it really was church. I mean, you know, the album captures largely the music part, but it was quite a long evening, quite a great evening. And one of the real amazing moments in it was that Maggie received a honorary doctorate.
Right, right. And you have that on there. That's
yes,
great.
Yes, yes. Triumphant, Virginia Triumphant.
Right.
And that was an incredible moment. But it was full on. You know, there was sermons and there was, you know, offering of the plate and the whole deal. So our whole goal with that album was to capture the feel of it, because to me that's what's mostly missing from most gospel CDs that I've come across, and I think we pulled it off. It's killer record.
Let's start at the beginning. You had alluded to this earlier. You're originally from upstate New York. You're not a Virginian at all, are you?
I'm not. Yeah,
how did you discover the world of folk life, and what drew you to it?
Wow. You know, I think of, you know, I mentioned that Clearwater Festival there in the Hudson River. I grew up Hudson River Valley. Actually, we probably wouldn't call it upstate, you know, although anyone from New York City would call it upstate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where's that?
Sorry.
But it's about 20 miles north of the city, a little town called Irvington. And I don't know. I just always had been drawn to, you know, I got a real early interest in the blues and gospel. You know, our town, although it's funny, you know, you hear about, you know, Westchester County is just, you know, people think of it as just kind of a homogeneous vanilla kind of place. And it's not at all. I mean, we had, you know, the Italians and the Irish and the Jewish population. Yeah. You know, it was real rich in many ways.
Take you going and learning how to be a folklorist to recognize that, or is that something
largely, you know, I mean, I think most people do, you know, I mean, there's kind of this idea of, okay, well, the folks down in Appalachia, they have the culture.
That's the real stuff.
And that has roots in the whole development of the field of folklore, you know, that's the folk, you know, and, you know, if you grew up in a environment that's, say, more suburban, then you're not folk. And you come to see that we all are. There's amazing culture everywhere. So I think I just, you know, I got into it that way. And then as I went on, you know, just through my life, I ended up, I had an experience where I got to teach elementary school down in New Orleans for a number of years after college, which was a total eye-opening experience and incredible cultural experience. And it really just turned me on, not just in terms of just enjoyment, but also got me thinking a lot about what's going on here in these parades.
Right. There was one day on the playground I want to lead you to.
Yeah.
One day on the playground, yeah, some rap was being played. And
yeah, I taught in elementary school, and they used to have us do lunch duty, the teachers. We had about a 12-minute lunch that we could eat, and then we were out on the schoolyard, and which there was a very under-resourced school. It was just basically a big blacktop, and these older boys, sixth graders, were playing basketball, and they were listening to you know, at the time they called it rap music. That they weren't really calling it hip hop music at that time, but it was kind of the early. This was right around 1990, 91, mm-hmm. somewhere mm-hmm. in there, and so they're listening to, I don't even know who it was, a rapper, and in the background they were sampling the Meters, which were the
right.
seminal funk group mm-hmm. from New Orleans, George Porter and Leo Nocentelli and yeah. Art Neville and. Zigaboo Modaleste. So, you know, they basically are really one of the forefathers of what we think mm-hmm. of as funk music. And, you know, they were playing, I think it was the Sissy Strut or something in the background. And, you know, I just perked up because, again, that for me, that was what made New Orleans.
Hey, they're sampling the Meters.
Yeah, I said, it's the Meters. And they're like, who? No, that's not the Meters. That's, you know,
whoever,
whatever, young MC or something. I said, no. You know, do you understand what's happening here? They're taking that music. And they didn't. But more disturbingly, they didn't know who the Meters were. They didn't have a clue. And here they are growing up in New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
You know, in the African-American community. They no clue. And I remember sharing this with we had a guy who came in and taught some music to students there who was a professional musician also. He played with Wanda Ruzan, mm-hmm. among others. And I told him about this one day. I said, you know, about this. And he said, oh, you should give George a call. I'm like, George? He's like, George Porter, you know, the uh-huh. bass player. And he said, yeah. And at the time, you know, I just didn't think you could do something
you
like that.
You mean I can call him
yeah,
at like, home?
Yeah.
Really?
And that's how some of these guys are. Like, you know, you think of these people as like, oh, they're untouchable. They're not. You know, I mean, and he gave me George's number. I called George and told him what happened and that I'd love for him to come to the school. And he did. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be transformative that day. It was incredible for everybody, including – I think myself and my relationship with my students, you mm-hmm. know, and it just sort of opened my eyes to the power of this stuff.
And you started to do more of it too, right? You had yeah. other musicians come in and yeah. talk to the kids.
Yeah, I was able to get a little grant from Jazz and Heritage Foundation who put on Jazz Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And we what it was to bring in local. I didn't think of it as folk life at the time. I didn't mm-hmm. think of it as traditional artists even at the time. To me, it was just New Orleans
yeah.
musicians. And culture, so we, you know, into schools. Mm-hmm. And it was there wasn't a real format for it. You know, we did it different each time. But we had, you know, first one we had Tuba Fats come in and to a school in the French Quarter. And we had Tommy Ridgely, you know,
right.
incredible. Walter Wolfman.
These are seminal New Orleans
yeah.
musicians.
Yeah. And then we had folks, like we had Kermit Ruffins, you know, who's nationally and globally mm-hmm. known now. We had Kermit Ruffins, he was probably... He's my age, so, you know, he was probably about 20, you know, mm-hmm. early 20s at the time, come in. We had the Rebirth Brass Band when those guys were young come in. We had Mardi Gras Indians come in, various members of that community.
So in a weird way, this what you were doing then is sort of what you're doing now,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah, it is. And I wanted, you know, that's what I wanted to do. And at the time, I was just new and kind of naive in this, and I thought, hey, got this little, I think it was a $5,000 grant, you know, and I just thought, hey, now I'm in, you know,
now
we're rolling.
Yeah,
we got the grant.
Yeah.
Here we go. The next one's going to just come right in.
Right.
And that wasn't the case. And in fact, I contacted the Louisiana Folk Arts Program.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know at the time. I had no idea at the time folk life, you know, what I do now even existed yet. And told them what I was doing and asked about grants. And they told me that the people that we were bringing in, like a Kermit Ruffins.
Or Rebirth Brass Band.
A Rebirth Brass Band. We're not traditional artists.
And this was because they were from an urban
Yeah, I think they're
environment
focused, yeah,
rather
I think
than a rural.
I think it was that same idea. You know, the Cajuns were traditional artists.
Yeah.
You know, the rural traditions were. But this, or the real older ones, I mean, you know, what Rebirth was doing at the time now is considered, you know, the sound of New Orleans. But mm-hmm. at the time, it was really a departure in a way from the real Dixieland style. You know, it is. A real kind of really brought a funk, kind of a real younger, you know, sort of drive to it. But they just, yeah, she just told me, you know, they weren't on the official roster, these kinds of things.
So I mean, you look back at that and you go, what?
I don't, unfortunately, I see it, like I said, I do see it still happening in a lot of states and a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of arts councils. And I don't mean to diss arts councils. I mean, and National Endowment for the Arts is our greatest patron, which is great.
And and that's where you get money for the apprenticeship program, correct?
Yeah, they've funded it every year generously. And so support the NEA. Don't believe what you hear. Folks are saying that's not a good use of our money. It's a tremendous use of our money. In fact, you know, when you hear about, you know, fiscal conservatives saying, oh, you know, we need to cut this stuff. Government shouldn't be paying for these things. They're kind of shooting themselves in the foot. I mean, they've done studies that say every dollar that goes into the arts and humanities have a $7 return. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably conservative. Right. So why would you take something like that away? You know, what it does for communities. You know, when you have something going on, when you have things going on culturally, when you have music, live music, when you have, you know, the arts, when you have new exhibits coming into museums, that revitalizes communities. That's what brings people here. And while they're here, they eat in restaurants and they stay in hotels and they buy gasoline.
And, right. And that also keeps regional flavor alive. You could make a tourism argument on that deal.
Yeah,
and,
which they're doing. So, you know, cultural tourism is now the
way to go.
The hot topic. So really, you know, you can't get more bang for your buck. Mm-hmm. So the arts are, you know, so I don't mean to diss arts councils except to say that they, you know, they often are just a little more restrictive places.
And maybe a little more political as well.
Yeah, so, again, that's a nice place to be. I feel very fortunate in that way.
Before we conclude, any hints as to what we can expect at the forthcoming Richmond Folk Festival, the Virginia Folk Life
Stage?
It's funny.
We are in deliberations. We have a couple ideas. But let's just say you might see some younger folks than you've seen before. You might see I'm going to leave it.
No, come on.
We try to keep this theme. It's hard. You know, it's hard to come up with a theme.
Well, how many years have you done this? You must be running out of themes at this point, or almost.
I guess 2005 was the first year.
Yeah.
And we've done it since year one. Our first theme was Instrument Makers of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at all kinds of instrument makers. And that's what inspired the stage. You know, and most of these, you know, the National Folk Festival, which is what Richmond started as, the folk life area was always just crafts. Or just material culture, we call it. So it's not just...
And you still have that.
And we still have that. But the very first year, because we're doing instrument makers, all these guys are incredible players.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not an instrument maker that I know in Virginia that's not also an excellent musician.
Yeah.
I think you almost have
to.
You
got to test them out, right?
Exactly. So I said, you know, we need a stage there. And I remember the folks from the National Council of Traditional Arts were sort of like, well, we don't really do that in the folk library.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, we got to do it here. You're not going to bring Wayne Henderson to Richmond
and then give them a place to play.
And so that's what created – that first year was what created this stage. And, you know, I will say that we've sort of given ourselves a break and not had to have the crafts and the stage have the same theme, which is what we always had done. Because some themes are very strong in terms of material culture and less so in music. Mm-hmm. And vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So, like last year, we did the Heritage Awards, as you said.
Right.
And I'd never answered that earlier question about what special challenges that had. I'd say in some ways it was easier because we knew who the people were.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we didn't make that decision. These people have all received
it was cut and pasted
National,
out for you.
National Heritage Award. You know, some of the challenges involved is, there's a number of these folks that are really quite getting on in years. Another challenge is that a lot of these folks are big time people.
Right.
We operate.
Yeah, you had Ralph Stanley there.
Yeah, we have a budget that we work with, you know. And
Jesse
and,
McReynolds, right?
Yeah. I mean, that brought Ralph Stanley.
From Jim and Jesse?
Yeah, Ralph Stanley, Jesse McReynolds. So a lot of these folks came, let's just say they appreciated what this was about and came probably for less than they.
Right.
Might otherwise. Right. So there were challenges like that. You know, dealing with management that we often don't have to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just, unfortunately, calling Ralph on the phone.
Yeah.
So it was a little different that way. But it was awesome. You know, it was really never been done before to have bring all the living National Heritage fellows together.
You also have the smartest people there at that stage, like the audience. You have
like
a very good audience.
I always praise the audience for their intelligence.
Yeah, what did you say? They were the
Mensa.
They were the Mensa
yes,
audiences.
Yes. So I always praise them for that. I think in all our festivals, one thing we try to do in our state, you know, it's almost like we're like a little festival within a festival sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And we really try to just kind of create an environment where these folks trust us because they're coming to see people they don't know who they are often. Especially a thing like Floyd Fest where you have these humongous acts, you know, and we're saying, hey, you want to come and see, you know, New Bowery Branch Bog Trotters.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first started doing it, those crowds were very small. Over the years, they've come to understand, you know, hey.
Trust us.
Trust us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We know
just
what
like
we're doing.
This fine show you do.
Oh,
come on. If you make it on the show, you are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's wrap this up quick. You're with Open Source RVA here on 97.3 FM, WRIR. I'm Don Harrison, and I've been speaking with John Lohman. He's the state folklorist of Virginia. If you want to learn more about all the great things that John and all the people at the Virginia Folklife Program are doing, you can go to virginiafolklife.org. Hey, thanks, John.
Thank you, Don. Appreciate it.
Everybody got somebody. Everybody but me. For me. I'm so lonely, sad and blue. Misery.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, June 7th, 2013. D-Day plus one. So far, Operation Overlord is going almost exactly to plan. We should be in Berlin by Veterans Day, so long as that Field Marshal Monty keeps up his end of things. I'm Chris Dovey. My co-hosts are Don Harrison and Scott Bass. The Richmond Public Media News team are Brittany Tracy, Cameron Vigliano, and Onofrio Castiglia. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Scardust. The advanced beachhead this week was established by Mike McKenzie. Don't forget that important advanced beachhead established on America's shores by our own families. Open Source RVA invites all of you to First Friday tonight, or given the possibility of a rain delay, to Monday's La Plaza Latin Market at Broad Rock Park between 4 p.m. and dusk to join us and tell the story of when your people washed up, bedraggled, and miserable on these welcoming beaches we call America. And don't forget to support Vox RVA as well as our regular endeavor, this little news operation we like to call Open Source RVA, by going to our website, rvaopensource.com. Click on the link that says donate and give till you feel like you're being taxed like a European. And while there, download this and past episodes of Open Source. Psst, the password is flash and the response is thunder. Or you can just email us your news tips at opensourcerva@gmail.com. Thanks for listening to this, our finest hour.
I've got to find someone to call my own. I'm so tired.